Recorded on location at Aspen Ideas Health in Aspen, Colorado.
Our guest is a nationally recognized expert on food insecurity and health outcomes. She focuses on programs and policies that make a difference in people's lives.
The bottom line of all of this is that food insecurity rates are going to rise. And when food insecurity rates rise, we see decreases in the population's health. We see people becoming sicker. We see the healthcare system having to bear the costs of increased chronic illness.
Dr. Hillary Seligman is professor of medicine, epidemiology, and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco.
WIC has proven that it can effectively support better health outcomes for mother and baby, and it has proven that it can be scaled. It's in every county in the United States. And so I call WIC the original Food is Medicine program.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Seligman, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
And we have an expert on SNAP. And, you know, this is an important time, I think, for our listeners to understand what's happening both in the House and the Senate version. I think it's one of the most profound cuts to the SNAP program, about 30%. I'm wondering, what's the lay of the land look like for you? What's the implications for people across the country who might lose their benefits?
Yeah, there's two things going on from a federal perspective that I think are really important to understand. One is proposals to drastically cut SNAP benefits, both the dollar value that people receive every month as well as who can enroll. And the other is efforts to restrict what foods people can buy with their SNAP benefits, which also is going to have a profound impact on people as well. And so I think we are looking at a generational change. SNAP is one of the largest anti-poverty programs in the United States. It is also enormously effective at supporting people's health. And so this is going to be a problem for years going forward as people lose access.
How many people are on the SNAP program?
About 45 million people. But what it's important to recognize in this federal landscape is that SNAP is what the economists call countercyclical. When the economy is good, people don't need SNAP benefits as much, and naturally SNAP enrollment falls. Right. And when the economy is poor and people lose jobs and unemployment rises, SNAP benefits rise. And the important part of that is that when people receive money for food through SNAP, that money gets spent immediately in local economic communities. Right. The USDA estimates that every dollar SNAP benefits generates a dollar and 80 cents of local economic activity. Right. So this is also a way that historically we've been able to keep our local economies moving.
Right. And not a surprise that when people lose their jobs, their reliance on food stamps go up. Yeah, I want to also ask for your thoughts on what has also happened, which is the $1 billion in cuts to food banks around the country. Maybe they're not as visible to everybody. We certainly saw during the COVID, when we were doing mass vaccines, how important those food banks were to helping people. But what's been the impact of the cuts to the food banks, which are kind of a partner program, if you will, to food stamps?
Thank you so much for asking that, because food banks are a vital part of the hunger safety net in the U.S. And historically, when SNAP benefits would be cut, the food banks were sort of the system of last resort. That's where people would go when they had no other options to fall back on. But we're seeing a simultaneous effort to reduce SNAP benefits and to massively cut funding to food
banks.
$1 billion. And so I think really the bottom line of all of this is that food insecurity rates are going to rise.
Yes.
And when food insecurity rates rise, we see decreases in the population's health. We see people becoming sicker. We see the healthcare system having to bear the costs of increased chronic illness and even more acute illness. This is going to be a problem moving forward.
And we see this across the age spectrum. We know our elderly rely on food banks, our babies and children, and everybody in the middle.
Exactly.
You were talking earlier about when the economy gets better, there are fewer people on it. That's the argument that the administration seems to be using, that the economy is better, we don't need a lot of it. What's the pushback on that?
Yeah, I think that's true. People do need less of this program when the economy is better. Mm-hmm. And that happens naturally. People lose their eligibility for SNAP benefits because they have a job, because they make more incomes, and they disenroll from the program. The average duration of utilization of SNAP benefits is very brief, on the order of months. People need SNAP benefits to help get them through an acutely difficult period, and then they come off when they have a job. And so that's really part of the challenge here. What the administration, though, is arguing is that we need to kick people off the program, people who otherwise would be eligible. And the important part of that is that across the population, most people actually can't work because they are children, they're older adults past retirement age, or they are disabled. Mm-hmm. And so really, these people are going to have to rely on SNAP benefits. And if they lose eligibility for SNAP benefits, there isn't a huge safety net, especially because of the food bank defunding.
And you know, it seems so much of this is very logical, and things that are complex to understand sometimes in policy are very clear around food, right? If we have inflation, food costs more, people can't buy it, they lose their food stamps, they really can't buy it, they eat less healthy food, we see them in the healthcare system with unhealthier status. Tell us about Eat San Francisco. I think this is an initiative that you've established to really try and put healthy food in the hands of people who need it. We'd love to hear more about that.
Great. Eat SF is what we call a produce prescription program. There are lots of efforts across the United States to try to better link the healthcare system with community access to food. You know, when I was a primary care physician practicing at San Francisco General, and I had a patient who was sick, I could write a prescription for an antibiotic and it would get sent to the pharmacy in the back of the grocery store and they could pick up that antibiotic
for
free.
No question asked.
No questions asked. But if I want to help my patients get access to healthy food, I can't fax a prescription to the front of the grocery store so they can get some produce. That's a systems problem that we can change. And there's a whole movement of medically tailored meals and medically tailored groceries and produce prescriptions that are trying to create that system to link healthcare and healthy food so that healthcare providers could write the prescription people need, not only to prevent chronic illness, but to treat it. EatSF is one of many produce prescription programs in the United States. We are really proud of the way we can reduce food insecurity, we can support better dietary intake, and we can help people to manage their chronic illnesses.
You know, one of the hats that we wear is that we're a federally qualified health center, and we go back to our founder, Dr. Jack Geiger, who early in his career started to prescribe food as a prescription for the problems that they were facing, which was obviously hunger. I'm wondering, though, about the current administration, because we hear them using the phrase food is medicine. We also hear them saying, should people be able to have soda pop as part of that? Where are the seams of opportunity to work together with them, if any?
Well, I think in this particular space, a lot is unknown, but there are a lot of potential opportunities. This administration has done a really deep dive into chronic disease. There is a desire to help make the population of the U.S. healthier again. And there is an interest in supporting better dietary intake. Mm-hmm. And the challenge, I think, for us is to amplify those efforts in a way that is based in science, that is based in evidence, and will support everybody in the U.S. equally. That really is the opportunity that we have. And whichever partners at the federal level, state level, and local level can help us reach that mission, we would be really happy to partner.
Where's the focus of that attention? Is the Department of Agriculture, is HHS, is it CMS, or is it all of them?
Well, part of the challenge is that it's all of them. USDA, FDA has a big role as well in regulating foods in front of package labels, et cetera. And CMS does a lot of the work around access to healthy foods through health insurance. So it is across many different federal agencies. And that's part of what makes working in food policy so challenging but interesting.
You know, I came into my career in public health and nursing when WIC was just arriving on the scene. And I thought, what a brilliant idea. I was in a rural, underserved, low-income area. And WIC has had to evolve over the years, right? There are some criticisms maybe about too many high-caloric things, but served its purpose. You've done some research that seems to really need to be brought forward about the health outcomes specifically of fruits and vegetables in the general population, I think also in maternal infant health as well. Tell us about some of your research findings and how that's driving your agenda forward.
Yeah, well, let's just start with talking about WIC for a minute. The first question that I always get asked about food as medicine programs, produce prescriptions, medically tailored meals, medically tailored groceries, is it effective? And the second question is, okay, but can it be scaled? And I will tell you, WIC has already proven this. WIC has proven that it can effectively support better health outcomes for mother and baby, and it has proven that it can be scaled. It's in every county in the United States. And so I call WIC the original food as medicine program.
That's great.
And I think they need to lean into that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of our work has supported really decades of evidence suggesting that WIC supports better health. And it also has sought to explore what could we achieve if we bumped up those benefits? Could we further support households and families in getting the food that they need to their children so that they can develop healthy palates, develop patterns of eating for the in their childhood that will support chronic disease prevention for the rest of their lives? We know that 42% of Americans are obese now, that cardiovascular disease is rising, that diabetes rates are rising, and diabetes is occurring even in children now and adolescents. But if we can support healthier dietary intake in programs like WIC, we can really make a difference.
Yeah.
You know, I want to ask the question about food policy, and I want to understand, what's the network look like that you work with? You're a national expert on it. But I also think people who are listening would be interested in, how did you come to this career? And what's the pathway that others might take to get into this really important work, because it has such an impact on the health and well-being of all citizens?
Yeah. Well, I'm trained as a primary care physician, and I started my career working as a physician at San Francisco General Hospital. And I actually was inspired by a patient with prediabetes who told me in the course of our conversation that every day for lunch, he ate a piece of Spam between two cinnamon rolls. And the reason for that was that it kept him full for the rest of the day. And he wasn't sure that he would have the money for dinner. And so it was possible that that was the only meal he would be able to eat that day. And so as a primary care physician, I sat there and I asked myself, I know I can get him medications. I know that I can prescribe him a drug that will help prevent progression of his prediabetes to diabetes. But what this person actually needs is healthy food. And that was the problem that drove me to start this line of inquiry. And so I always tell people, find that thing that just doesn't feel right to you and try to figure out how you can make a difference there.
And you know, back maybe a little bit disproportionate, I'll speak to the FQHCs, seeing FQHCs as part of a link in the chain or the primary care centers at UCSF perhaps, where you might actually distribute food, where you might actually hold those once a week. It's like the diaper bank, there's the food bank, there's these essential things that are not $1 million ticket items, right? They're very fundamental, but they make a big difference. What's your engagement with the healthcare system in San Francisco, maybe beyond UCSF? Are you working with the network of community clinics, migrant farm workers, FQHCs? Tell us about that network.
Yeah, we work with whichever health systems are interested in having our support in developing food as medicine types of programming within their health system. And I want to emphasize that this is a little bit of a Band-Aid, and I'm really happy that we started with SNAP because SNAP, if SNAP were available to everybody in this country who needed it, and we were effectively using that as a lever to support people's healthy diets, we wouldn't need
to do these. Of course, the emergencies.
We wouldn't need to be doing this through healthcare, and we wouldn't need to be supporting people through food banks. And so I have been a real champion of supporting this work through healthcare because otherwise people are falling through the cracks. But ultimately, the best answer to food insecurity and the health impacts of food insecurity is going to lie in a better hunger safety net, in a hunger safety net that works for everybody in the U.S.
That's great. You know, we're at the Aspen Ideas Health Gathering, and we're hearing from a lot of different people. One of the groups that we heard from were farmers and the impact. And maybe talk about, you talked earlier about the dollar having a force multiplier effect in terms of the economy, but what about farmers and the impact that this might have on them?
Yeah, such an important question. So first of all, there are a number of additional programs that are threatened to be defunded in the current environment. And some of those are funding programs that move crop directly from farmers, especially small and mid-sized farmers, to schools and to food banks. This is particularly challenging in this moment because this defunding is happening at a moment when many of the farmers at this very festival have told us they've already put crop into the ground.
Right.
And so how are they going to harvest the crop without the funding that they had that they had been promised? So I do think that we're going to have a shakeup to the system that's going to be very, very challenging for our small and medium-sized farmers as well. One of the things that these food as medicine programs that move healthy food into healthcare have also done really well is to develop links or systems that connect farmers directly to healthcare organizations through produce boxes.
Right.
And these have also been a really important strategy for moving healthy food, particularly to people with diabetes or people with heart failure.
But I wanted to ask you, as a primary care internist here, we have heard so much about GLP-1s here at this conference and obesity. And I think two different issues, hunger and obesity, two different issues. We need to sort of look at them differently. But what's your take on the GLP-1s as a potential to really improve health through reducing obesity when so many other things have failed for so many people?
Yeah. Really important tool in the toolbox, GLP-1s, but they're not going to solve all of our problems. And in particular, you know, 9 in 10 people in the United States exceed recommended sodium intake. Most Americans, 8 out of 10, don't meet dietary guidance for fruits and vegetables. GLP-1s can't be our only tool. We have to be able to change our food system in a way that healthy foods are available to everybody who wants to consume them. The generational shift in obesity rates that has happened over the last 40 to 50 years is not primarily a problem of genes. Our genes have not changed, but our food environment has changed dramatically. And so we have to be working on the environment at the same time as we're working on the medications.
So what do you think about the Secretary Kennedy's focus in on some of the food industry being bad actors here? I'm not sure red dyes are the only thing that there may, but certainly sugar in the food. What do you see the food industry's responsibility and how would you address that? Is that, doesn't seem with this administration, is it going to happen through regulation? Is it going to happen through public persuasion or how do you see it?
I don't know how the changes in the food industry are going to happen. I will say that lessons we learned from tobacco were that it took intervention or activity on many, many different fronts.
Right.
There was regulation, there were changes in cultural norms, there were changes in the media, there were changes in policies in restaurants and bars and local communities. And we are going to need that same type of multi-level approach. In the context of food, it is also going to take some powerful leverage to to rein in the food industry. And we just have to do that. There is not going to be a way to solve this problem if we don't change the way the food industry is acting in this space.
Well, Margaret, I remember Mayor Bloomberg was able to get smoking out of
restaurants.
But was not able to get the larger size Cokes sodas, and sodas right. out as well. So much more powerful, and that was an right. impressive lift, but right. not able to do it all the way.
But those partnerships are key. And I know you're the deputy scientific lead for the American Heart Association, if I get this whole title right. Healthcare by Food.
That's
I wrote
right.
it down. Initiative, it's another arm to exercise research through, and certainly a national presence that can help deliver that message. Tell us about your work with them and some of the research that you have going on.
Yeah, so the goal of that initiative through the American Heart Association is to create a system where health insurers, private, public, both of them, reliably fund healthy food as a strategy towards improving mm-hmm. health. They fund or pay for medication. They should fund or pay for healthy food as well. What these insurers tell us that they need in order to make those changes, among some other things, is they need research yeah. that tells us who should be covered, for how long, using what kind of strategy. Is it medically tailored meals? Is it a produce prescription? Is it medically tailored groceries? What does it look like? And what outcomes should we expect? And the goal of this initiative is to try to answer those questions and to try to create a system that would functionally allow reimbursement to happen just as seamlessly as sending a prescription to the pharmacy, mm-hmm. that we could seamlessly deliver healthy food to patients when they needed it, and that would be reimbursed by healthcare. Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to also identify another hat that you wear. You're also the direct the Nutrition and Obesity Policy Research and Evaluation Network with CDC. Maybe talk to us a little bit about their work.
Yeah. So CDC has a really important role in bringing together and supporting state and local health departments in doing the policy and systems and environmental level work that creates, as we like to say in public health, making the healthy choice the easy choice. And this encompasses a range of things like what kinds of foods are being offered in your work cafeteria. What kinds of breastfeeding support is there? What kinds of produce prescription programs are available in your community? And so what I do as the director of NOPRIN is try to bring together academic researchers and state and local public health department implementers and other implementers to try to catalyze that work. As you alluded to just a minute ago, Bloomberg was able to make some changes in tobacco that weren't possible with food. Food is complex. It's hard to make these changes. And the only hopes we have of doing it is through partnerships with communities. And that takes support.
Right.
It takes a lot of people helping to build that infrastructure. And that's the goal of NOPRIN.
Wow, that's great.
Well, Hillary, I know you're in an academic medical center as well as deep into your community, but I would imagine you are precepting, teaching, supporting research at every level of the pipeline of the healthcare workforce. What do you see in the generation coming up? Is this a passion for them? Is there a recognition that, gosh, we can't just rely on drugs to fix these things? There are systemic, political, social, and very tangible things like food that people need. Tell us about your teaching educational work.
So, first of all, I will say when I was coming up through this work and leaning towards doing more research and policy, the goal was to train people to do exceptional research and policy. And that is not a goal of this generation. It is a sub-goal. The goal is to have an impact in the community. And I love that generational change. This generation is motivated, they are passionate, but they don't want to learn to do research for research's sake. They want to learn to do research so they can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what we try to do. We try to respond to that drive. I direct the National Clinician Scholars Program, where that really is our mission. I do that at UCSF, is to is to support people in becoming change makers. And that means understanding how to do research and to use data, mm-hmm. but also understanding how policy works mm-hmm. and how to be an effective leader within a really complex ecosystem.
You know, food insecurity has been with us since the beginning of time. Any new technologies that you see on the horizon that you're encouraged by?
You know, I'm going to have to say no to that question for mm-hmm. this reason.
I was going to ask if AI was one of those technologies, because well, we've got to get AI. If we got GLP in one, we've got to get AI into this conversation.
Well, this is the thing. Fundamentally, nutrition is really simple. And we have a problem in public health sometimes and with our communication of making things really complicated. Fundamentally, it's simple. And we need to keep it simple because that's the most important message. Eat more fruits and vegetables. Eat more lean protein, plant protein if you can do it, and eat more whole grains. If you can do that, you will be in good shape.
Can I add to that?
Yes.
On plant protein, being someone who's been a vegetarian for decades and decades, unless you start early with plant protein, the mouth taste is just not something I've seen with older people being able to succeed in making that transition. So doing this at a younger age is really critical. That doesn't mean old people can't change.
Absolutely. Can. And that comes back to the WIC point, which is establishing healthy palates really early in life. Right. And you mentioned school meals. Yeah. You know, school meals are the healthiest meal most children get all day long. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so these efforts to provide healthy meals and access to plant proteins through the National School Lunch Program are really important because that's how kids are starting to build their palates.
Mm-hmm. I would think just on the delivery system of food, though, there's something around understanding that science. Getting local food grown closer to where people are is really important. So are there people who are sort of charting that out of if food is medicine, it's got to be somewhat grown in my neighborhood. That may be hard if I'm in New York City. It may be hard to distribute if I'm in a frontier region of the country. So who's thinking about that distribution network so that we can start growing more locally?
Yeah. And that experience for kids.
Yes.
What does this taste like, look like? It's exciting.
Yes. Kids, right? Well, what you're calling attention to is a systems approach to this work that looks at the entire food system and looks at it from the perspective of health as well as things like climate change and sustainability. And that also brings into this work another federal agency that we didn't mention before, which is EPA, has a lot of interest in this area.
Great.
And again, it is calling attention to the complexity of this work, that we have this big complicated system, but also that food for people is not just what do you have access to today. Food is really about people's identity, people's joy, people's experience and social relationships with other people, how they connect with their ancestors. Food means so much to people. And so being able to weave people's individual experience with food all the way up to these climate change, this is the fundamental problem. And this is, I think, where we need to do better in this field.
What a great summary statement for the show, Dr. Hilary Seligman. Thank you for joining us for Conversations on Healthcare, coming to you at the Aspen Ideas Health. Thank you to our audience for joining us. And remember, follow us on Facebook or X, YouTube. And please, we always love to hear from you and share your comments. Thank you again, Hilary, for joining us. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.